And what's really cool about game design is it does help you embrace ambiguity. It helps you think in sort of an iterative way to discuss what you think is really, really, I think, essential to creating an engaging experience. And so what I think charms people, and I think the real opportunity with the news, is to understand the way we approach problems in games and how we look to solve them.
Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell, and I decided to take a little break this week from the Society for News Design's audio that we've had over the last few weeks, and actually post an interview that we did a few weeks ago. In the studio now with me is Nicole Grisco.
Hello.
And we had an opportunity to talk to Lindsay Grace of American University. He's a game designer and researcher. He also runs the AU Game Lab and Studio. So we actually got a chance to talk about gaming and sort of the intersection between game design and journalism. And it turned out to be kind of an interesting little talk. What do you think?
As someone that doesn't play a whole lot of games, and you told me that we were going to do this for the podcast, I was like, okay, all right. No, but I thought that even as someone that doesn't play a whole lot of games, there were lessons to be learned in the way that we think about how we tell our stories and how we even solve our problems. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. And sometimes we got him to be a little technical, talk a little about how he got into gaming and really kind of what interests him. And I think there's a lot to learn in here. So enjoy our podcast. So I guess the first question is, why are you in here talking to us on a journalism podcast about gaming? Where's the connection?
Sure. So there's actually been several sort of historical connections between games and news media in particular. So there was this sort of rash, I'd say about 5 years ago, of what we call news games, which were games that were basically trying to either sort of category of reportage games, where people are reporting through games, and then there are a bunch of editorial games. And the intersection for me in particular is in the space between editorial games and persuasive play. So the idea is to try and engage people with current topics by framing some of those challenges affecting people's perspectives by offering them a game experience.
To sort of build on that then, how can journalists use games to tell stories?
Sure. So there are several ways. I think one of the things that's most sort of promising these days is using games as a kind of inroads into the complexity of a particular story. So we know from years and years of making digital games in particular that they're really good at changing people's perspectives, for giving them an opportunity to sort of put themselves in someone else's shoes. So in the history of persuasive games, one of the things that people often don't recognize is that the game Monopoly, which is played in lots of living rooms across the U.S. and abroad, was originally designed as a persuasive game. It was designed to help people understand a theory called sort of Georgist economics and how landlording can actually create a sort of impoverished situation. And we've had that tradition. It's that what people have begun to realize is that we can really produce some very compelling entrees into complex topics through games.
Could you give us maybe an example of how a game that would apply to maybe a current issue or a current event that's going on right now?
Sure. So I just gave a talk at South by, and we actually listed a bunch of games that were engaged in trying to help people understand, say, the way government operates. So there's about three or four games these days that all afford people the ability to balance the federal budget. And the idea is to make it a play experience, but at the same time give people an understanding of how complex that task is. And that's sort of part of the rhetoric of those games. There are also games, they're very editorial, but I like a designer who goes by Amal Industria. And he makes games about the politics behind mobile phones, so producing iOS games or iOS devices, and also games around large corporations and how they operate, and giving people that perspective.
So why use games? I mean, what does it really sort of accomplish in your storytelling? Is it an enriching experience, or is the game in itself the thing that you should be doing?
Sure. So there are a couple of things that happen. One is that we've been the science of game design is really about engagement and understanding how to compel people to want to play more. And so we've got a nice sort of strong tradition in engagement design, and that's actually a lot of what I teach. It's not sort of the standards of game design, but it's actually about how to attract an audience, keep an audience, and keep them compelled to want to stay in the world that you've created for them. And so that's one of the draws. The other draw is that we see in sort of recent history, the last 5 years, a tremendous growth in the number of players and the kinds of players. So that the demographic of a player is widening. People love to cite the Electronic Software Association statistic that the average gamer is 31, that it's about a 47% to 53% female-male ratio within games. And that larger demographic says a lot about how people are playing and what engages audiences. The other trick is that we're also noticing that games are not, I think a lot of times when people think about games, they think of console games. They think Xbox, they think PlayStation. And the reality is that there are tons of players in mobile spaces. So one of the statistics I love to give is the number of hours spent playing Angry Birds on a daily basis. If you calculate it out, it basically calculates to about 16 years worth of play. There are so many people playing that game on a daily basis, trying to fling birds across the level that it's really interesting to say, what can we do to take that energy and maybe direct it towards understanding news media?
Yeah, what can we do to sort of take that game mechanic of throwing things at other objects in order to tell a bigger and a more interesting story? How did you get into gaming? What's your path to this?
So I don't know that my path is particularly common, but basically what happened was when I was a kid, about 7 or 8 years old, I played my first PC games. I got so excited about them. I went to the library and started learning how to code. And so I started making my first games around 9, 10 years old, did it for a while, and then basically discovered around 13, 14, that girls weren't really interested in guys who made games. So I stopped for a while and then went back to it after starting a .com and deciding that I really wanted to teach. And so one of the colleges that I was teaching for really needed someone to teach script writing for games, which is really about trying to write narrative for games. And that's how I got back into it.
What can you tell me about the Persuasive Play Lab? It sounds like such an interesting idea.
Sure, sure. So the one that we're operating at American University is largely focused on, as mentioned, designing games that help change people's perspective, interests, or activities. And the way we do that is we try to create compelling, short experiences that help people understand either the complexity of a specific scenario or the variety of sort of perspectives on one experience. So to give you an example, I've made some games that are about helping people understand how they can problem solve differently. So one of the things people rarely understand is that when you're a game designer, games aren't really about choices, they're about problems. So we produce problems as game designers and then we offer the solutions. And so it's about those solutions being offered that really creates an opportunity for persuasive play. So if I tell you the only way to solve your problem is to eliminate your enemy, well, that's one solution. But what about negotiating with your enemy? What about providing your enemy some other distraction? There's lots of other ways to solve problems. And so a lot of what persuasive play does is it offers what we call different game verbs. And my own personal practice called critical gameplay does the same. So I have games about discriminating on something other than appearance. So maybe it's behavior. I have games about stopping to smell the flowers. I have games about hugging past your obstacles instead of shooting your obstacles, those sorts of things.
Is it difficult to sort of fit different types of stories into a sort of a game environment? Or is it, do you think that there's always a way to get into that?
Well, I think it really depends. There's multiple ways to look at game design. I tend to bias, and what I've been teaching for the last decade or so is something that's very focused on mechanics. It's focused on how you solve your problems in games. So I have a series of lectures that I give around people attributing a specific problem and a specific verb to that problem. So at the Games for Change Festival a couple of years ago, I gave this lecture about how a lot of times we create this platform mechanic to help people understand far more complex things. And the platform mechanic is basically that you run and you jump. And so the irony is that we're trying to help people understand, I don't know, how to conserve water by running and jumping. And those two verbs don't really match with the problem, right? We should actually have some kind of conservation verb that's quite satisfying for players. And that's one approach. The other approach, there's a lot of people who do a sort of more narrative approach. And the idea is to involve people and characters and give them the opportunity to take on a role, right? So there's a standard a role-playing game. And there are even more. There are approaches around something we call critical design, where we're really just sort of asking what's the convention and how can we upend that convention to create new experiences. A lot of it has to do with your particular goal in design.
I like that you mentioned that there's more than one way to solve a problem, uh-huh. because I feel like now, especially with news media, it's always so black and white. And I feel like what you're describing describes that gray area that we just rarely ever get to, you know, even in a traditional story almost, I guess.
It seems like you want to sort of identify what the problem is. Maybe not something that journalists don't always, well, I guess they're supposed to. They're supposed to say, what's this problem I'm trying to report on?
So one of the things that's interesting, and I'll sort of describe where some of this context is coming from. So we started this year a Knight Foundation-funded initiative called the Jolt Initiative, which is really about trying to understand what journalism can learn from the tradition of game design. And we know that there's opportunities in engagement, but we also know there's a sense of sort of disruptive leadership, which I think is the really novel space. So that acceptance of ambiguity is part of game design. We don't live in the black and white. As soon as you invent something, the next thing you have to do is sort of say, well, what can I do now? And every time you create something, you've also created a new problem for yourself because you've got to improve on it. And what's really cool about game design is it does help you embrace ambiguity. It helps you think in sort of an iterative way to discuss what you think is really, really, I think, essential to creating an engaging experience. And so what I think charms people, and I think the real opportunity with the news, is to understand the way we approach problems in games and how we look to solve them.
Very cool.
Very, very, very cool. In 2013, your game Wait was picked for the 10th anniversary Games for Change Festival's Hall of Fame as one of the five best games for social impact. Tell us about Wait. What is it?
Sure. So Wait is probably about my fourth or fifth game in something I call the Critical Gameplay Design Project. And essentially what I'm trying to do is get people to understand how we can play differently. So in Wait, what happens is people are presented with a 3D world that is completely sort of barren. And then as you wait a little bit, the green field sort of, it becomes verdant and you see this grass wave back and forth. And then if you wait longer, trees start to appear, butterflies, all kinds of objects in a heavily forested space. But as soon as you move, all of that disappears. So the game's mechanic is really about trying to, take the cliche, it's really about stopping and smelling the flowers. So every time you move, the world disappears, but you only get points for seeing things. And likewise, you actually need to handle the other side, which is if you wait too long, you miss the opportunity and the world starts to dissipate as well. And I got the idea, honestly, from reading The Alchemist. And the idea, and one very small part of that book, someone is asked to walk around a building watching a spoon and not spilling the oil in the spoon. And I thought, well, how interesting, because first time he goes through, he only worries about the spoon. Next time he goes through, he doesn't worry about the spoon and he notices all the stuff in the building, but he spills the oil. And it's nice sort of metaphor for the balance in life, right? This sort of seeing and doing and participating, which is a tension in within games, because many games are about racing to the end or about destroying the environment you're in. And what I liked about Wait and the approach I was trying to go for is to help people appreciate the built environment.
Do you find yourself sort of designing games out of metaphors? Is that something that's a...
There is often. So particularly because I'm interested in game verbs, I'm also trying to find the opportunity where those game verbs collide with a kind of metaphorical reality, a thing that we are concerned about in the world. So most of these games, and this is why they're persuasive play games, a lot of these games are oriented towards trying to help people see the world differently and solve their problems differently.
So I'm a journalist. Yeah. At what point do I start thinking, well, maybe I should start incorporating games into my news coverage in presenting the stories that I'm working on?
Sure. So there's a couple of spaces, and we've actually talked to a couple of news agencies about sort of when and what makes sense. The first, I think, and the really sort of low-hanging fruit is whenever you're trying to affect people's perspective, that sense of a role play of putting people in someone else's shoes is really quite compelling. And we've had a couple of examples of that, times when we've asked people, say, in a game to check their cell phone while driving, and they notice how difficult that is, and it's a nice way to get an argument to help people understand the tension there. The other is when you want people to practice something, the sort of the long-term science from psychology particularly on play is that play is a place for experimentation and a place for practice. And so if you construct good play experiences, you can kind of encourage people to play in sort of pro-social ways, but you can also encourage them to play in order to practice a way of thinking or practice a way of solving problems. And so if you're trying to inform an audience about something that isn't as simple as I can give it to you in five statements, it's a really nice way to bridge that gap, especially when it's something complex that needs to be simplified.
So does the game have to be fun to be good?
Ooh, that's a classic question. And one of the reasons it's a classic question is, and I'm going to get academic for a second here, there are some wonderful sets of books, actually, on what it means to be fun. And the one I like most is a recently departed phenomenal researcher named Brian Sutton Smith, who has these seven rhetorics of play. And essentially what he says is that each one of us has a kind of a hodgepodge of these seven rhetorics. They're things that we are compelled to in play. And some of them identify, some of them have to do with identity. So it's about us being a part of community. So if you look at a parade, that's a kind of play within community. There's also, or identity, there's also people who are about sort of adventure. And so there's that attraction, or competition is an attraction. So there's a lot of formal literature about what makes fun. If I were to answer your question very quickly, I would say fun really does depend. So there's something we talk about called hard play or deep play. And in both of those cases, it's something that is extrinsically motivating, even though the experience isn't. So my classic example is you really want to learn French because you're going to Paris. It may not be fun to learn French at the time, but you're very excited about the end result. So a lot of educational experiences tend to have that dynamic where someday it's going to be great.
It's the reward.
Yeah.
There needs to be some
carrot at the end.
Some carrot at the end to motivate you to move through it. Now, this is your first. This is American University's first year with a game design class in the communication department. So, were you involved in putting together the curriculum?
Yes.
And how did that happen? Go on.
So, I wrote the curriculum and had some really great input from lots of other faculty and lots of other folks at the university. And the essential motivation was that the university had noticed that they are very well positioned to do work within this persuasive play domain. So, nice, strong journalism program, two deans who both have a sort of foot in games, which worked out really well. And the university itself is quite excited about something they're calling the 2030 Initiative. So, they've got about four or five programs that they are trying to become, for lack of a better word, preeminent in by the year 2030. And this is one of them. So one of our, I think our bragging points is in our first year, Princeton Review ranked us as the number 21 grad school in game design in the country. So in one year, we went from no one's ever heard of us to being a top 25 program.
Oh, cool. Well, and there are more than 25 schools.
There's about 150 schools.
Okay, good. Well, there are actually 22 schools, so no, it's not quite as impressive. So I'm a student coming into the game design program. Actually, let me back up even before that. What's going to get me interested in that program? What type of student are you, or have you seen come in and you hope to see come in?
So our students are, it's interesting. Our students and the folks that we're most excited about enrolling the program are folks who are interested in doing more than entertainment in games. So they have a wide array of interests from education to museum design to what we fundamentally call social impact. And they come in with a little bit of experience in that space. So to give you a sense, the way I wrote the curriculum was that we wanted to allow people to choose a focus. So of the 36 hours, 9 credit hours are to be taken at any of the graduate programs within the university. So if you want to come to AU and become the next independent games company, you could take our curriculum and then take essentially 3 courses in the Kogod School of Business. If you want to understand, as 3 of our students are doing right now, the intersection of news and games, then you take some of the journalism courses as part of your curriculum. And it's really interesting. I can give you a sense. One of our students started a kind of news source through graphic novels. We have another student who's coming from Nigeria, who's just very passionate about game development. We have another student who's a Navy commander who's interested in starting a business upon a retirement. We've got students who are coming from very, very interesting spaces. Lots of students are interested in education and games and realize this opportunity for social impact. And it's nice because we can align them. Part of the curriculum aligns them with our game studio, which produces games, and our game studio clients are people looking for these particular needs.
So, explain then the game studio.
Sure.
Do you have businesses coming in?
Yes. So the initiative is really twofold. It's a curricular initiative, and then it's also a kind of entrepreneurial initiative. So this is a third game studio that I've run in an academic setting. And the short version is we work with clients to solve their problems through games. And sometimes those are very typical sort of, we want a mobile game to help people understand a training component, or we want a mobile game to improve our brand. And then some of them are actually a bit more complicated. So one not to be named federal agency was very interested in trying to understand how they could motivate people to complete these very specific profiles more completely. And so we talked to them about engagement strategies to get people who aren't within the organization, these aren't employees, these are people volunteering, to participate, and how we sort of reward them and structure an experience that makes them feel good about participating in the environment.
And it's interesting because before you mentioned one of your students being in museum design, and I actually had a conversation with somebody at a conference who works in a museum. And one of the challenges that they have is they have all this material, that they need to tell a story. Yep. And, you know, we've all gone to museums and we all put those awful headphones or those sticks that we listen to as somebody guides us through it.
Yep.
But, you know, getting a game presentation into that is probably a great way to sort of bring in the immersiveness of a museum.
So one of the things that I think a lot of people, I think, can get value out of games or game design is that I think folks should understand that game design is really about experience. And so content may be king, but experience is the kingdom. And so there's this really nice opportunity for people to understand, if they sort of study game design, how to keep people in your kingdom.
So before we started our discussion here, I asked you if you'd be willing to talk about Gamergate, because
okay.
one would assume that you might have an opinion about that.
Yep.
We had a couple of podcasts over the last year where we talked about that. There'll be links to those podcasts, but we won't go into a lengthy discussion about it. But basically, there have been people, including journalists, who have been subjected to all types of nasty behavior from people who disagree with their stance on gaming and gaming community, mm-hmm. et cetera. So what are your thoughts on this?
So it pains me a little bit in that one of the reasons I started working in the games industry, and particularly in games academia, was that it was actually quite an open environment. And it was an environment that really sort of said everything's cool and everything's interesting. What happens as things mature is that I think essentially what's happening with a lot of the Gamergate folks is that they're feeling encroached upon and becoming territorial. Don't mess with my first person shooter. Don't mess with what I understand games to be. And it's quite frustrating, because that can signal the death of a community as much as a maturation of the community. I've been much less so than many of the people who've really been affected by Gamergate, but there have been a serious conspiracy theorists who want to implicate myself and some of my peers. And really, what's fascinating about it from a very objective perspective is that they have created a game out of the dynamic itself. So it's that they're such avid game players that they're trying to find a conspiracy that can be played with, and it's really sort of a strange scenario. I am embarrassed by the Gamergate behavior, and I'm surprised that this is the same community I entered 7 years ago.
Uh-huh. Sort of what you were talking about. I mean, if you play a game, you're immersed in something, mm-hmm. and it's something that's very much personal, mm-hmm. and your experience is personal.
Mm-hmm.
And so you quite often will view a lot of things from that perspective. You know, maybe you're not stepping back and looking at it in a more global and open attitude, an accepting attitude, mm-hmm. I would guess. That's my opinion.
Yeah. And the gaming that you're describing earlier in the conversation that we've been having is, to me, for lack of a better word, it's very like peaceful way of talking about a problem and just, you know, it's sort
of
strange.
One of the people who came under attack, and I can't remember the woman's name, had designed a game that was very social forward. Do you know what I'm talking about?
So it's either Zoe Quinn or Brianna Wu.
I think it's Zoe.
Okay. And yeah. Actually, it's such a small world. So I gave a talk at Boston Festival Independent Games with both of them years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And it still was very much a different environment. So there is this tension that I think people may not be aware of. As the industry matures, there's sort of several areas of practice. And one of them is what we call AAA games, which is the large, big budget games. And then we've got folks in the indie community, and they are distinctly part of the independent games community, which is, in some ways, I think, shares attributes with something like independent film or independent radio. And what's really cool about the independent games community is it's still very much a sort of like, hey, you made something interesting. Let's support each other and let's just keep making interesting things. I'm giving a talk in 2 days about the sense of diversity. And I think one of the really important things that the independent games community has done to support diversity is it's basically letting everybody get a little light. And some things are going to grow and some things aren't. But the affordance, the ability to say, listen, sure, we'll show your crazy game, moves the industry forward. And once it starts going the other way, it just hurts itself.
Something you mentioned earlier on about the breakdown is, you know, gender-wise, mm-hmm. How does it compare to what it was 10, 15 years ago in the gaming community? Is it changing?
So ostensibly it is changing, but if you read a lot of editorials, what you'll find is that the tension is still there in unhealthy ways. It's there in gender, it's there in I think some cultural aspects as well, and some racial aspects. But what I really do have to champion that there are spaces where people are working very hard to make sure that they They do support that. So I was recently talking at the Game Developers Conference, which is our largest conference, about 25,000 people. And I was invited down to talk to people who are basically recruiting at Sony for PlayStation. And they were very clear about their interest in making sure that they have a representative workforce that is at least pretty close in terms of distribution of demographics to their audience.
Do you think some of it's just a resistance to change, that we like the, we want it to progress in a certain track?
I think there are people, particularly if we go back to Gamergate, there are people who have a variety of anxieties, and when things change, those anxieties rise. And so their identity for some of these people is quite closely tied to these games or this community. And whenever that community changes, they feel threatened in an unhealthy way. I think everybody should get used to change because that's how the world works. Nothing stays the same. And I think that's where some of that stress is coming from, and the backlash and the anger and the things that make absolutely no sense because people are having irrational responses to quite rational experiences.
Okay. Could you describe the gaming process, the game process,
sure.
The game design process? What's your process for putting together a game?
Sure. So when you're doing purposeful play, which is just one dynamic, the first thing to do is really, or one sort of way of producing games, the first thing is to really understand the problem you're trying to address. And then what we do is we work that single problem. So let's say it's about encouraging young children to read. And then you take that problem and you break it into smaller sets of problems that are actually engaging and satisfying. And so part of it may be, well, if we want to encourage children to read, and this is just me going off the top of my head, we might say, well, kids like mysteries. And so if we give them a series of mechanics that help them unfold a mystery, and then we attach game verbs to that that have to do with practicing reading or being engaged in reading, then we can kind of motivate them. So, you know, off the top of my head, a game might involve going to your library and investigating a book and finding the author of a book just to get students in the library at all. And so the idea is that they are practicing, which is a fundamental element of play, the activities, the behaviors that you want them to effectively adopt. And then eventually what happens is you start to sort of mold a series of aesthetics and a series of more finite experiences until you've got a kind of complete game. And that's a kind of a constructivist approach where you've got these very small components that you then build like Legos into a complete game. But there are other ways to do it.
Now, I know that, you know, I've played video games for the last few decades. Since they were in arcades, I played video games, and the progression has been really kind of interesting to see. And once you got into the console games, where the games are much more sophisticated, mm-hmm. where you would actually immerse yourself into a community, but it almost got to a point where you're sort of beyond the illusion that it's a reality, because you, in the end, you're there to do a task so that you can move forward. Mm-hmm. You know, how difficult is it to create that sort of feeling that, to convince somebody that the experience that they're having is that they're in, mm-hmm. and then, but you still have to get them to the end so that they are motivated to move on in the game.
Sure.
As opposed to just sitting there.
Sure.
And going, wow, this is real cool.
There are several structures that we actually employ. And so one of them is often cited. It's part of something we call positive psychology. Csikszentmihalyi, sort of the parent of this progeny, this idea of flow. So what essentially happens is we are always in game design trying to balance an experience so that people aren't bored and they're not anxious. If they're anxious, they don't want to play, they throw it down. Forget this, it frustrates me. If they're bored, there's no reason to continue. And so there's this channel between boredom and anxiety that we can balance. And he's actually formally identified it with about 9 attributes. And you can kind of detect those attributes and say, okay, we're having a problem. And I want to take a step back and remind folks that game design is multifaceted. So if we talk about the big successes in game design, I would really have to champion something like Angry Birds because of the wide demographic and the challenge of making a free game an extraordinarily profitable game. So in the early days of the sort of game design, the arcade model was standard. And the arcade model always kept you at the cusp of a big win, enough that you would have to deposit another quarter. And so that's a sort of cheap trick, right? It's a kind of a carnival trick. Oh, you could shoot that balloon, but you just need to give me another quarter to be able to do it. What we've discovered, particularly in this space called free-to-play games, is there's a really, really set of interesting and sometimes complex psychological behaviors that can be affected by games that really draw people in. And so they, the free-to-play people in particular, have got this down to a bit of a science. So a lot of the very successful, very profitable games in the mobile space identify their minnows, their dolphins, and their whales. And so the whale is the one who spends the most most money on your game, and the minnows are the ones who, you know, play it a little bit and occasionally spend money. And that model, what they're doing is they're actively engaging with psychology. Some of the companies are actually hiring psychologists to help them figure out what points they need to start charging people for a gameplay experience or how they keep people involved. And the large companies do that as well. So Microsoft has this nice little suite of folks who are very good at doing big data analysis. At the same time, they understand human behavior, and they're actually looking at their games and saying, at this point, we need to make it easier. We need to make it harder because we're losing people for one reason or another.
Hmm. That's pretty fascinating. So somebody wants to be a game designer. What do they got to do? Besides go to your
right, besides go to American University.
Yeah, no, you know, I'm a senior in high school. I'm a student in college where I'm not exactly sure what direction I want to go. Yep. What are the skills that I should be thinking about picking up? You know, what's a good course for me?
Sure. So the first thing I do is I've been teaching for 11 years, so I've had this conversation a lot. And the first question I ask any sort of student who's interested is what they're interested in. So typically we have three main tracks within games education and with game production, and they are development, so coding and making the games, aesthetic and art, which are really about making the visual assets for a game, and then design. And the design folks, some of the most successful design students that I've had have BAs in English. And really, the people who are most interested in design tend to be people who are interested in problems, creating interesting dynamics. They like to create problems and solve problems perpetually. And I think, you know, I was an English major as an undergrad, and I think there's something about the way we learn to read text that we actually translate into designing game experiences. And there's a tradition within game academics called Well Played, where you're actually reading a game like a text, like a well-read book. And I think that confluence is pretty common. So in terms of what do you do next, the short version is you really need to start to understand games as a multidisciplinary practice. You need to get a liberal arts education. So one of the things that I tell people is that game design is the kind of liberal arts education of the 21st century. It was actually the theme of one of my GDC talks. And the reason is a good game designer has a sense of psychology. They have a sense of sociology, so they understand the culture in which they're putting a game. They have a sense for game development, so they actually know a little programming. They also know formal logic. So there's something called constitutive rules that dominate games like chess, that are really quite formal in their relationship to their problems. And it's math. It's nothing more than a kind of logic math. And then a variety of specific inroads. So people who are interested in education should be taking education courses. And that's why I really love the space of game design in particular. It just feels like it's sort of a modern liberal art.
It's sort of the merging of the science and the art.
Yep.
And also the fact that you lean so much on the narrative,
mm-hmm.
That goes through so much of, well, certainly journalism, but so much the storytelling aspects of just a lot of the liberal arts. So, and the creativity and that aspect of it. Well, this has been great. I did want to ask you one last thing. Where do you see games going at this point?
Sure, my prognostication for the future.
How is game design going to sort of change? How is it going to change us?
So I'll give you my ideal utopian experience. So
utopias have worked out so well so far,
right? So, and it's funny because often in games it's all about a dystopic environment because that's the one with lots of problems, which is why you want to play it. So one of the things that I think I don't want to say probable future, but a nice future for games. There's this history, right? In the last century where people lived and operated businesses and all kinds of other practices without marketing. And now it's almost absurd to say you don't have a marketing plan. What I'd love to see is that people start to say, wait, you don't have a game designer on your team and you're trying to engage people? Something's wrong there, right? And realistically, I think I've been teaching engagement design longer than game design as a formal structure. And I think that's the future for game design. It's not about this separate other. It's about all the things we've gathered from it and learned from it. So the same way that various media inform each other, so film informs practices in traditional written literature, I think that games, because they have become such a sort of an integral part of whole generations at this point, I think what we'll find is that people will be expecting some gamic or ludic elements, some playful elements in much of what they do. It'll be a standard engagement strategy.
Yeah. Well, those who have listened to this podcast for a while know that I'm something of a geek and I was a comic book geek for a very long time and an observer of popular culture. And the way gaming has sort of just inserted itself into the middle of that and really dominated it in many ways is just been mind-blowing just to see it happen in a good way, yep. I think. Because I think it because games can be good. Games can sort of change the way people interact with each other and do positive things. Well, this has been great. I really enjoyed talking to you. This is good.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find more info on us and download other episodes at itsalljournalism.com. This podcast is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.